keenly eyeing reconstruction, as is evident by the campaign slogan of Hope Through Work. The fact that 14 million people, or 78% of the electorate, turned out to cast ballots for the candidates of their choice, with the incumbents garnering 95% of the votes, is a proof of the aspirations of the Syrian people and a firm slap on the face of the U.S. and other enemies of President Assad, including the illegal Zionist entity. Not just the sizable Christian minority, which has no trust in the pro-terrorist policies of the U.S. and Europe, the Sunni Muslim majority of Syria, including the army, know very well that their freedom, dignity, and stability of the country are indebted to the strong and independent political leadership of the Assad family, the late Hafez, and the incumbent Dr. Bashar. They have not forgotten how France, during its League of Nations mandate between the two world wars, had separated Lebanon and in 1937 handed over Iskenderun and what is now Hatay province to Turkey. They remember the rise and fall of over a dozen governments in Damascus since 1946, within a period of only 24 years, before the emergence in 1970 of the Alawite statesman, Air Force Chief and Defense Minister Hafez al-Assad, to grant stability to the country, which 3 years earlier in 1967 had lost the Golan Heights to the Israeli regime. In other words, whatever Syria has achieved as a strong frontline state against the usurpation of Palestine and has weathered a decade-long terrorist conspiracy to balkanize the country is because of the now 51-year-long rule of the Assads, father and son, who have always favored the unity of the whole Levant, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, and Palestine, into a solid block in view of the common culture, history, and the Arabic dialect of the region. This is what alarms the West and the U.S. in pursuit of its hegemonic policy to keep the Levant divided and to strengthen the illegal Zionist entity. They had hatched the destabilization plus in 2011, which has now clearly failed. Now, with government forces poised for mop-up operations in Idlib and the other occupied enclaves, the re-election of President Bashar al-Assad for another 7-year term will certainly help the Syrian people in rebuilding the country and ensuring its independence.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip are still reeling from the most recent Israeli onslaught against the coastal territory. Such scenes of destruction are seen throughout Gaza, with many families camping near their flattened homes. It could take many months before these ruined buildings are rebuilt. Israel's devastating onslaught left scores of Palestinians, including dozens of children, dead. The war was another stark reminder of how brutal the regime can be in dealing with the people it has subjugated for many decades. The Israelis argued during the operation that they were trying to wipe out resistance groups and their capabilities. But that's implausible because the sheer number of civilian casualties and horrific scenes of destruction of residential buildings leave no doubt that the regime committed numerous crimes and violations during its latest war. On Thursday, the United Nations Human Rights Council voted to launch an international investigation into the war. The draft resolution was presented by Pakistan on behalf of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation and the Palestinian delegation to the United Nations. Pakistan's ambassador to the OIC, Khalil Hashmi, who was speaking on behalf of the organization, sharply criticized Israel's supporters. He blasted Israel's allies for shielding the occupier from global accountability and providing arms and ammunition for its widely reported war crimes and crimes of apartheid against the Palestinian people. United Nations Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet had tough words for Israel. She rejected Israeli claims that the destroyed buildings in Gaza were hosting members of the Palestinian resistance groups or used for military purposes. Meanwhile, the UN Rights Chief also criticized Hamas for firing rockets at Israeli cities, saying it constituted, quote, a clear violation of international humanitarian law. Thursday's announcement of an international investigation into alleged crimes committed during the 11-day war seems to have enraged the Israelis. The regime was quick to reject the decision, saying it would not cooperate with the probe. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas, on the other hand, welcomed the investigation. The United States, which has observer status and no vote at the Geneva Forum, refrained from speaking at the special session. The investigators will have a broad mandate to look into all alleged violations. The probe will cover not just the Gaza Strip, but also the occupied West Bank and the Israeli cities, which came under retaliatory rocket attacks by Palestinian resistance groups. Future findings of the independent investigation are expected to once again mount pressure on the Israeli regime. But will its allies allow any meaningful action against it? The U.S. in particular has been extremely supportive of Tel Aviv. Observers believe this unwavering support leaves no room for the U.S. to want to be a mediator between the Israelis and the Palestinians.
For people in Palestine, for many, many countries in the world, the notion of the United States being a mediator is simply a derisory. It's a joke, and nobody believes it. But for internal domestic consumption, that's important. It also is a fig leaf for Europeans, particularly the British, but others, to say, well, the United States is in charge and we don't have to do anything. But I think increasingly, and we see that, increasingly the United States is no longer considered to be a mediator. The Palestinians, for sure, cannot continue to do this. Abbas cannot continue to agree to these things, and that's obvious.
Tensions between Russia and the U.S. are on the rise over the START Treaty. Russia has accused the U.S. of failing to stick to its obligations under the new Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, known as the START Arms Control Treaty. Moscow has accused Washington of exceeding the agreed limit on the number of American launchers and bombers. Moscow says 56 U.S. launchers and 41 heavy bombers had been removed from Washington's declared arsenal.
Well, both countries are playing this game. We know that they have enough capabilities to destroy each other and the whole world. But, we can understand human desire to gain the dominance. So I'm sure that both Russia and United States are working, trying to find maybe new ways of, fighting and so on. However, I mean, the idea is that they have to make an agreement and have to stick with it to avoid this crazy situation.
Moscow says that it is unable to confirm that they are no longer nuclear capable. Russia also says four underground missile silos have been removed from the count. According to the calculation provided by the Russian army, the U.S. has exceeded the figure allowed under the treaty by 101.
So far, the START agreement worked, but we do know that the people in Pentagon always, dream of winning nuclear war. At least Russians understand that we need to have parity. Nobody will win the war. That's why we shouldn't start. But I can imagine there are some people that are trying to do that. But mostly it is a game of accusations, which, you know, more or less calls for both sides to sit at the table of negotiations and negotiate with each other further.
Washington has rejected Moscow's claim, saying that the U.S. is in full compliance with the treaty obligations. Russia has in the past raised similar concerns over Washington's violation of the Strategic Arms Control Treaty. The New START represents the last major treaty binding the U.S. and Russian nuclear arsenals. The agreement was negotiated by the Obama administration and caps the number of deployed nuclear warheads each country can have at 1,550 apiece. It also allows the two states to have no more than 700 deployed missiles and bombers.
The situation is not particularly promising, but what we have to realize, like as we learned within a couple of hours ago, that finally the two leaders agreed to meet in Geneva on June, I think, 16th. So I think, you know, what I would say that Biden's bite is more than that he can chew, that the United States build their policy on this very negative rhetoric against Russia.
Russia had long called for extending the treaty. It is set to expire on February 5. The administration of ex-U.S. President Donald Trump only entered talks on the matter last year and conditioned the extension on a list of demands. New START is the last remaining non-proliferation deal between Russia and the U.S. after the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, or the INF, another key arms control treaty that expired in August 2019. Russia has already announced that it was leaving the treaty on open skies, which allows reconnaissance flights over the participants' entire territory, months after the U.S. under Trump unilaterally quit the key trust-building pact. Back in 2020, the U.S. announced the deployment of a new long-range nuclear missile aboard its stealth submarines to deter what it calls Washington's potential adversaries. The 2019 Congressional Budget Office report showed that Washington seeks to boost its nuclear capabilities, estimating that it will spend some $500 billion in nuclear weapons from 2019 through 2028.
Polls in Syria presidential election closed on Wednesday at midnight after authorities extended voting by 5 hours due to the high turnout. A week earlier, Syrian refugees and expatriates across the world voted in their country's embassies. More than 12,000 polling centers across Syria received the voters. According to the Interior Ministry, a total of 18 million Syrians at home and abroad were eligible to vote in the election. Incumbent Bashar al-Assad is expected to win a fourth 7-year term in office in a contest with a former state minister Abdullah Saloum Abdullah and an opposition figure Mahmoud Mari. Assad enjoys widespread popularity across the country. In 2014, he secured almost 89% of the votes on a turnout of over 73%. After he cast his vote at a polling station in the city of Duma near Damascus, Assad told reporters that the Western opinions about the validity of the ongoing election process in his country have zero value.
The mobilization that we have seen in recent weeks was a clear response, and it says to them, your opinions have zero value, and you are worth 10 times less.
Assad made the comments after the United States, Britain, France, Germany, and Italy claimed that Syria's presidential vote is neither free nor fair. In a joint statement, the foreign ministers of the Western countries also called the vote fraudulent and that it does not represent any progress toward a political settlement. However, Damascus says the election is a sovereign Syrian affair, and that only Syrians have the final word in the matter. Results are due to be announced by Friday evening.
Well, the big thing it teaches us is that an organized resistance of the whole people is able to push back U.S. imperialism, its determination to destroy Syria. This election is a big, big step in asserting their sovereignty and asserting their right to choose their own leadership. And I think that's why there's so much enthusiasm in Syria for this momentous day.
Since the beginning of the Western-backed war in 2011 to topple Assad's government, Syria is experiencing a protracted political and socio-economical crisis that has caused a severe deterioration of living conditions. Thousands of Syrians have died since the outbreak of the Western-backed war in 2011 to topple President Assad. After failing to oust the Syrian government through proxies and direct involvement, the U.S. government stepped up its economic war on Syria by imposing crippling sanctions. The sanctions have severely hit the war-torn country's economy by prohibiting foreign companies from trading with Damascus. Meanwhile, the U.S. and European countries have banned export and investment in Syria, as well as transactions involving oil and hydrocarbon products. Also, smuggling of strategic Syrian resources is another tactic used to put pressure on the Syrian government. The government says the Israeli regime and its Western and regional allies are aiding Daesh Takfiri terrorist groups wreaking havoc in the country. Nevertheless, the Syrian government has proved effective as Syrians continue to recapture key areas from remnants of the Daesh Takfiri terrorist group and other foreign-backed terrorist factions across the country. But the presence of U.S. and European forces, in addition to Turkish troops, has slowed down the advances.
Well, from the very beginning, the U.S. hasn't wanted the Syrian people to decide anything, wanted to decide for them. And it's not only in parts of Syria, but Syrians around the world.
10 years of foreign-sponsored war in Syria has left more than 380,000 people dead. The UN says nearly 12,000 children have been killed or wounded so far. More than half of Syria's pre-war population of 22 million have fled their homes. Syria is in dire need of help, but surely the West has so far offered nothing but destruction and death to Syrians.
Palestinians have poured to the streets to celebrate their victory over Israel in the 11-day fighting between the two sides. Rallies were held across the besieged Gaza Strip in condemnation of the Israeli regime and celebration of its defeat. Gatherings were also held in the occupied West Bank, where joyful participants cheered for the victory for the resistance. The celebrations came after an Egypt-brokered ceasefire went into effect on Friday morning, ending the fiercest battle there in years. This wasn't the first time the besieged territory came under Israeli fire. But this time, Palestinians turned the tables against the regime and launched unprecedented rocket and drone attacks on Israeli cities, inflicting damage and casualties on the enemy. Experts believe that Israel has succumbed to the unprecedented response by the Palestinian resistance and agreed to the ceasefire without any preconditions.
I think it's a huge win. The fact is that never before have we seen Israel penetrated militarily, psychologically, and morally in this way before. The sheer numbers of Palestinian resistance missiles that actually penetrated the Iron Dome is absolutely incredible. This much-vaunted dome, which was meant to protect the Israeli civilians, essentially collapsed, because my estimation is around 30% of the missiles got through. And what were these missiles? Essentially, they were just homemade rockets. Not only that, what we've seen is that this, for the first time, turned into an insurrection within occupied Palestinian territory. Within the colony itself, they call Israel, you saw huge numbers of Palestinians demonstrating and rising up, and actually huge clashes took place. A lot of that would have been suppressed.
People across the world have shown their solidarity with Palestinians in the past few days. In the United States, protesters called for the cessation of all funding to Israel. As the Israeli regime was targeting the people of Palestine, the U.S. administration approved the sale of $735 million in precision-guided weapons to the Israeli regime. The arms deal is now pending the approval of Congress. Several American congresspeople, including Senator Bernie Sanders and House Representatives Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Mark Pocan, and Rashida Tlaib, objected to the plan and introduced motions to block the sales. But given the traditionally strong support for Israel in the Congress, the motions will almost certainly fail.
The U.S. is totally $3.5 billion per annum is donated by Israel to by America to Israel in order to sustain its arms industry. As the bombs were falling on Palestinian children, you found that Joe Biden cleared $750 million of aid for arms and missiles to Israel. So that was the initial response of America.
In the meantime, U.S. President Joe Biden has welcomed the ceasefire, expressing hope that it would hold. He, however, reaffirmed the U.S. support for the Israeli regime. Several Israeli political and military figures have questioned Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's motives for launching the offensive on the Gaza Strip and approving a ceasefire without any strategic breakthrough for the regime. Netanyahu's political opponents speculate that the premier ordered the strikes after he failed to establish a coalition cabinet to put an end to Israel's political stalemate. But the developments over the past 2 weeks have shown that the next time the regime ventures an offensive against Gaza, it could face consequences more serious than a political vacuum in Tel Aviv.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all of time.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
By the first verse of the Holy Quran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Allah will bless you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Protect you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Help you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
So ask His blessings.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His protection.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His help.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, boys and girls, and other life forms. Welcome to today's episode of Youth Station.
Choo-choo-ka-choo, it's the Youth Station for you. This is Sister Zainab Barakat.
And that's Brother Mudaffar Haidar.
That's me.
He's okay. I mean, you know what? I'm just too old to argue about this anymore.
I'm an acquired taste. An acquired taste.
Oh, you're an acquired taste.
Did you say quiet taste?
Yeah.
No, I'm an acquired taste.
You really are an acquired taste. Anyway, we're just going to pick up what we were discussing from the last episode, how we were talking about youth and the risk of being alienated.
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 Hated by aliens?
Yes. The youth and...
Do you know what? I laugh at my good jokes. People laugh at the bad ones.
It's the bad jokes that that show your genuine
you
self.
You are laughing at me, not with me.
Youth and the risks of being lonely and not having a society, not having a group or circle of friends with whom they can socialize. Let's talk about how awfully that affects their lives.
Yeah, people get depressed.
Depression is definitely one of it. Depression and the feeling that no one understands them, no one supports them, the feeling that what if I'm in the wrong and the majority of the society that I'm living in is doing the right thing because they seem so much happier and prosperous than I am.
Yeah, and then they just keep sinking and sinking down that lonely, lonely hole.
Which is really sad. And then, like, even if they wanted to seek therapy, I feel like even the therapists in those non-Islamic societies don't exactly understand or can relate to the problems our Muslim youth would.
No, but what's interesting is not only are we social creatures, the religion of Islam is a very social religion as well.
It is, unfortunately.
The sister doesn't like the social elements.
No, I still fail to see how a panic attack is khair for me in any way, sort or form. But hey, if God says it's good, then it's probably good. It probably burns out calories and helps me lose weight or something. I don't know.
But you notice, like, the salatul jama'ah.
Exactly.
Right? You know, Allah's saying the best way to pray is together. You know,
Eating alone is makruh.
Eating alone.
SubhanAllah. Yeah. Share your meal with someone.
You love eating alone, don't you?
I really do. Eating with someone else stresses me out.
That's a picture. No, you take a little picture, you put it on Instagram.
Exactly.
And then you're like, I'm going to devour this now on my own. Watching something on TV. That's what you do.
Oh my God, do you have carrots that I'm in my home?
Huh?
No.
I'm just guessing. But
that was, that bullseye right there.
But for me, I don't like eating on my own.
What does it do to you?
To eat on my own?
Yeah, what does it do
inside your head?
No, what does it do inside your head? What feelings come over you that you don't enjoy eating alone?
Let me try and vision it. Okay, so there's a plate in front of you and you're eating it and nobody's around.
Do you feel miserable?
You feel kind of empty, like I am not feeding my soul or my heart. No, man, that is really beautiful if you think about it, sister.
Really?
Allah wants you to sit with others, to share your food. I mean, that is, if you look at what counselors tell families, for example, they always say, you know, make the dinner time, you know, the time for the family to sit together and talk together. Switch off the TV, move away from that. This is your time to interact.
SubhanAllah.
Which is interesting because it's also makruh to speak with your mouth full.
Right.
But at the same time, it's that feeling of having somebody else with you, you know, feeling the chinking of the glasses and the plates and you know, just looking at each other chewing, which, again, is...
Gross.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to throw something out there.
Bismillah.
You entertain the thought for, you know, argument's sake, and we see how well would it work out. Okay. How about if Muslim youth don't necessarily focus... they live supposedly in a community with zilch Muslims.
Zilch Muslims. Absolutely no Muslims. They're full of
They live Christians in Alaska. They live in freaking Alaska.
Alaska?
Yeah.
Alaska has a Muslim community.
Dang it.
Yeah.
They live in...
Sweden. No, Sweden has... My uncle is there.
Dude.
Yeah. I don't know a place... That's what I'm saying.
North Korea.
Ah, North Korea.
It's perfect.
It's... King
Kim Jong-un?
He's not...
Muslim?
No, he's not one of us.
Dude, no.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
I've been going about this wrong my whole life.
How do you think... what is the plausibility of them vibing with non-Muslims?
Oh, very good.
Moral... non-Muslims that are... That have good values, good morals. They're nice and sound people. They're not... necessarily someone who adheres to getting drunk every weekend. You know, they're really good people. They could be good Catholics. They could be good Jews. It's all right to vibe with them, right?
Of course. The Quran says that, you know, Allah does not forbid you from acting kindly and being good with people who are not trying to kill you, who are not trying to fight you.
Yeah.
Right? If somebody's not trying to fight you actively, they're not trying to attack your religion.
Then the default is to be good with
them. The default is
to
be good
with them. And vibe with them. And I think if we do that, we will create that sort of, that dialogue, that necessary dialogue that has been missing in a lot of our societies and cultures.
See, where this becomes complicated, sister, is places like India, where Hindus are interacting with Muslims. And Hindus are not like Christians and Jews.
No.
So that...
It makes life very
hard. Really complicates things. Mm. I mean, I've done a kind of ad hoc case study comparing Indians to Pakistanis, because uh-huh. they're really similar people, right?
Yeah.
Same culture, same language, same food, right?
Same but they big, hate each other, brown eyes,
which is hilarious. Anyway, but I found that hilarious. Pakistanis are a little, like, when it comes to their kind of revolutionary ethos and understanding of Islam, I feel it's much deeper, generally speaking. Why? Because the Muslims in India mm-hmm. are still preoccupied with, look, can I eat this from the Hindu's hand?
That's sad.
They're just kind of stuck in those kind of issues. Whereas the Pakistanis, because, you know,
they don't have those things to worry about. They've moved on from that.
So this is just an additional benefit to actually living in an Islamic society.
Exactly, definitely.
But yeah, I mean, as long as you're, if you're living in a non-Islamic society, as long as you're adhering to these basic ahkam, yeah, I mean, it's going to be a little bit tricky for you, but I mean, it's
I know a lot of Catholic and Jewish families, or Christian families in general, that are very, very thoughtful and courteous toward their Muslim associates, whether it's their neighbor or someone in the community, or to make sure to give them something. If they're giving them a food, make sure that it doesn't have alcohol in it. Or
you didn't come to the online Palestine session. We had Reverend Frank Gelly.
Yeah,
on there.
Reverend Frank.
He was very nice.
Very nice.
Very nice.
He really was very nice. I especially loved his WhatsApp profile image.
He has this he's more revolutionary than so many so-called revolutionaries, right? And at the same time, I can see what you mean about this courtesy, this friendship. This,
exactly.
I've noticed actually something from the Christians. I hope you don't mind me saying, but he said, I've met Christians, right, who have reverted to Islam, and they're studying in the Hawza.
Okay.
I've noticed when somebody converts from Christianity to Islam, they have this, for want of a better word, niceness about them. Yeah, yeah, yeah. They have something about them, the way they talk, the way they interact. I asked one of them. His name's Anthony. God bless him. He's one of my best friends, right? He's become Muslim, right? And I was like, man, I've noticed this trait in Christians. What is it? What is it about you guys? What did you do? Because he was training to be a reverend. So he's got the Hawza training for Christianity,
exactly.
And then he's coming. I was like, what is it? He says, well, we have this concept of grace. He's Indian. In Christianity.
Masha
grace.
Allah.
You've heard Christians say that kind of stuff, right?
Yes,
grace and stuff.
Beautiful.
The way they carry themselves, that nice. I don't know. What does the Quran say? You will find those...
The Christians, yeah.
Yeah, they'll be the closest in affection towards you.
If you were to... Okay, this is totally irrelevant to the topic of our discussion on Youth Station today, which is about solutions for Muslim youth living in non-Islamic societies, whether reverts or born Muslims. And one of the important salient problems that they face is alienation and feeling lonely.
Alienation.
And alienated.
Alienated.
And loneliness.
They're in an alien nation.
What do you think is the equivalent for grace in Islam?
We have a concept of grace in Islam. Mm.
But one solution that we thought about was joining online communities, online Muslim societies, whether the society is here back home, wherever your back home is, or whether it's, you know, the society that is there but it's hard for you to reach, or sometimes just go the extra mile to go to one of the centers. Sometimes maybe you can even vibe and chill with the non-Muslims, like the Christians and Jews, that are closer to you and more compatible to you in terms of their values and their morals, which will affect their morale. And while Brother Muzaffar is thinking about the equivalent of grace in Islam,
I think I found it.
What?
It's the concept of forgiveness. It's a concept that we often overlook. See,
like Ghufran.
Yeah, if you forgive somebody, then Allah is more likely to forgive you on the Day of Judgment, right? Why? Because when you forgive somebody, it changes your personality. Mm. It changes who you are.
Yep.
And so your heart becomes softer, and it's easier for Allah to put you into paradise, into the Jannah, because of that grace that exists in your heart. I don't know.
Next solution, if you could recommend anything to the Muslim, I would recommend reading books. Just turn into a bookworm, you're going to be fine.
That was your solution, sister.
No?
And
It's not. It won't work out for other people. It's not doable, you think?
Well, are we trying to give them solutions to? Are we giving them coping mechanisms here?
Coping mechanisms, solutions. Don't get yourself killed. Potato, potato.
Okay. Yeah, books. Why not? Right. Go read a book.
I mean, dude, come on.
I'm really lonely. I've got no friends. Go read a book.
That does sound like
just enjoy it.
I mean, like, save the English accent. That literally is me.
That's your inner voice coming. That's your inner voice, isn't it?
It is.
Just go read a book.
Dude, my inner voice literally is British.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know why. Cynical. Yeah, exactly. There's a hadith from Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam, where His Eminence says, "He who finds companionship and solace in books has not lost anything."
No way. Why have I never heard this?
Way.
I've never heard that.
You heard it today on
YouTube.
I thought
you were
going
to say something else, which is also relevant to the topic.
Wait.
He said, "One who is abandoned by family will find comfort and refuge with strangers."
Exactly. Let not that comfort be in a way that, I don't know. Like, sometimes when you get really, really desperate, and out of desperation, you click with the wrong crowd.
Mm.
And then that will kind of begin to manipulate and...
Been there, done that, yeah.
Right?
You've got to
compromise your ideologies and your doctrine, and then, like...
Look, at the end of the day, the place where you are living is going to have an effect on you.
Definitely.
Who you are. It is definitely, definitely, 100%. We have a hadith that says, if you want to know a person's deen, look at their circle of friends.
Yup.
You had a different hadith?
No, I said yup.
Yep.
And my deen my deen is non-existing.
Yeah.
I have no forever alone. Oh, there's another hadith, though. We're going to wrap it up with that hadith as well. You know, we're just going hard on the hadith from Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali. He says, loneliness is better than a bad companion.
No way.
And that's a big deal. Solitude is better than a bad company. Maybe not in loneliness, because loneliness has such a thin line between that and, like, clinical depression. So let's not go there.
Yeah, loneliness.
But solitude is better than a bad companion. So legit, if you find yourself in a society where you can't click with anyone and no one is vibable, you just embrace being alienated.
You don't need no one.
You don't need no one, sister.
You don't need anyone. You know, two friends are a single soul in separate bodies, according to Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Beautiful.
You got a whole family out here.
Yes. Right? We got your back. Yep.
We're just far away.
Exactly.
So you should just go, chill out, read a book. You don't
and
need
think
no
about
book.
Us. Yeah. And we think about you. And inshallah soon, I'll send you frozen falafel. That's all the time we have for Youth Station. Thank you for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
I am what I am because you made. I have what I have. My love is strong because you are the one I call creator, my Alpha and Omega, my protector and my maker. Because of you, in weakness I am braver, my defender and my savior, my giver and my taker. Abiding in silence with patience and guidance, aware when I need you, the light when I seek you. Justice, forgiveness, the strength in my weakness, and my love is strong.
in the limelight.
The world's leading insurance companies, especially U.S. ones, are underwriting and investing in industries that drive planetary heating, destroy ecosystems, and violate human rights. According to Insuring Disaster, a new report released recently by a United Kingdom-based financial industry watchdog. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kenny Stancil Ryder. This article is published under the heading U.S. Insurance Giants, Worsening Climate Crisis, Biodiversity Loss and Human Rights Violations. Stay tuned for more. The world's leading insurance companies, especially U.S. ones, are underwriting and investing in industries that drive planetary heating, destroy ecosystems, and violate human rights, according to Insuring Disaster, a new report released recently by a United Kingdom-based financial industry watchdog. In what it described as the first comprehensive assessment of insurers' environmental, social, and corporate governance, ESG credentials, Share Action analyzed and ranked how 70 of the world's biggest insurance companies, together responsible for assets totaling $22 trillion, are approaching responsible investment governance, the climate emergency, biodiversity loss, and human rights. In contrast to their reputation as risk experts who assesses, manages, and help reduce social and environmental risks, the majority of large insurers fail to adequately address systematic risks such as climate change and biodiversity loss, wrote the authors of the report, which was based on company surveys and an examination of publicly available data. Almost half of insurers, that is about 46%, received an E, the lowest grade, while another 17% received a D rating. Just 16% demonstrated a relatively strong performance that merited a rating of B or higher. Yet, even the leading insurer scored just over 50% of the available points, the report said. On average, insurers scored only 12% of all available points. We hope this unprecedented overview of the industry offers a wake-up call to insurers, report co-author Felix Nagrawala said in a statement. These ratings must improve and quickly if the industry hopes to survive a future built on renewables and equity, not fossil fuels and slave labor. No insurer received an AA or AAA rating, although five European companies received an A grade. The performance of U.S. insurers, meanwhile, was remarkably poor. Share Action gave an E to 75% of U.S. insurance companies, compared with 52% in Asia and 22% in Europe. Of the 12 lowest-ranked insurers with a property and casualty business, half were U.S. insurance giants Nationwide, AIG, Allstate, Genworth Financial, Protective Life, and Travelers that scored 5% or lower on issues of governance, climate, biodiversity, and human rights. Furthermore, of the 15 lowest-ranked life and health insurers, which scored 3% or lower on the four categories being evaluated, 9 were U.S. companies. RiverSource, Northwestern Mutual, Talcott Resolution, Pacific Life, Lincoln Financial Group, Protective Life, Mass Mutual, Brighthouse Financial, and Aflac. The U.S. insurance industry is buying its head in the sand as the rest of the world races to embrace a greener, cleaner, and more equitable future, said Nagarala. Despite the sector's expertise in identifying, forecasting, and managing risk, it continues to support companies responsible for climate change, including those engaged in coal, tar, sands, and Arctic oil and gas. These aggregated results from this study showed that while the world's top insurers received an average score of 27% on the topic of governance, they performed even worse on the climate crisis, 11%, human rights, 8%, and biodiversity, about 3%. By continuing to underwrite and invest in fossil fuel extraction and disregard the well-being of working people, by neglecting dangerous workplace conditions, gender and racial discrimination, child and forced labor in supply chains, and forced displacement of communities, insurance companies, particularly U.S. ones, are exacerbating environmental and social crises even more than other actors in the financial sector. The stronger ESG policies and practices, the report said. Despite the fact that insurers make up 12 of the 26 members of the United Nations convened Net Zero Asset Owners Alliance, and despite plans for a Net Zero Insurance Alliance, only 13% of asset insurers have made net zero commitments for investments, and just 3% have a net zero policy for underwriting activities, according to ShareAction. Insurers are better placed than any other type of private financial institution to exert pressure on the coal industry, as coal projects cannot be financed, built, or operated without insurance coverage, the report noted. But U.S. providers are largely failing to use this influence. In fact, of the 7 assessed U.S. insurance companies with a property and casualty business, Liberty Mutual is the only one with a policy that restricts underwriting for coal projects, ShareAction pointed out. By contrast, 54% of non-U.S. insurers impose restrictions on underwriting for coal projects. However, ShareAction said that none of the 70 companies receiving scrutiny has placed limits on underwriting for gas and oil, despite a 2018 warning from UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change that building new fossil fuel projects and keeping global warming below 1.5 degrees Celsius are incompatible. The analysis of the global insurance industry comes on the heels of a bombshell report published last week by the International Energy Agency, in which the relatively conservative institution made clear that remaining fossil fuels must stay in the ground if the world is to avert the most catastrophic effects of the climate emergency. Regarding biodiversity loss, the vast majority of assessed insurers have not yet developed an approach to managing nature-related risks to their portfolios and show little understanding of how their investment and underwriting activities are driving or may be affected by the biodiversity crisis, the report noted. Moreover, nearly three-quarters of assessed insurance companies, that is about 73%, do not have an investment policy covering human and labor rights, ShareAction found. Only 13% of assessed insurers have made a commitment not to invest in companies that are knowingly in breach of human and labor rights, showing that the industry is willing to turn a blind eye to direct and deliberate corporate human rights violations, the authors wrote. North American insurers are the worst offenders. Not a single one of the 24 insurers from the U.S. or Canada has a policy. Underscoring the need for the insurance industry to evolve, the report noted that only one of the 7 assessed U.S. insurers with a property and casualty business has carried out climate scenario analysis to identify long-term risks to their portfolios, compared with 46% of non-U.S. peers. ShareAction called that particularly alarming in the context of recent wildfires in the U.S., which in California in 2020 alone caused insured losses of an estimated $8 billion.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on March 21st, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Nowruz.
The characteristics of an ideal president. The next point is addressed to the masses of the people. I wish to mention the characteristics that an ideal president should have. You people should see if this is really the case. These characteristics are not my personal viewpoints. It seems that anyone looking for the welfare of the country wants such a president. First of all, he should be competent. He should possess managerial qualities and managerial competence. Secondly, he should be religious. If he were irreligious, it would not be possible to trust him. An irreligious person will sell the country and its interests and people. Therefore, he should be religious. After that, he should be after justice and fight against corruption. This is one of the most important characteristics that should exist in a president. He should pursue justice in the real sense of the word, and want to fight against corruption in the true sense of the word. He should have a revolutionary and jihadi performance. One cannot work with a pretentious and ceremonial manner. With all the fundamental issues that exist in the country, there is a need for a jihadi and revolutionary performance. He should have such a performance. He should believe in domestic capabilities. There are some individuals who do not believe in domestic capabilities at all. They repeat the same cliché that inside the country, it is only possible to build clay ewers. However, they do not know what is happening inside the country. Once a gentleman said something about our defensive capabilities. Then I said that we should hold on exhibition so that such gentlemen come and see what is happening in the country in terms of defensive capabilities. Presidential candidates should be really sure about the capabilities of the country. They should also believe in the youth. They should recognize the youth as the engine of the country's general movement, and they should trust them.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to
Around the World with Reporters.
Activists are galvanizing opposition to the government's planned controversial policing bill, which is now close to becoming law, highlighting a number of issues as more Kill the Bill protests are planned.
It's a massive assault on our democratic right to protest in this country. And let's be clear here, this is specifically aimed at the environmental movement, thousands of young people on the streets demanding that we tackle the climate emergency, and the Black Lives Matter movement, thousands of young people on the streets demanding justice for black people. And when the government saw these two movements in the summer of last year taking to the streets as they did, they decided that they needed to put in place the most draconian legislation.
Many anticipate a new wave of protest as concerns over the right of assembly grow.
I think this will be the government's poll tax movement moment, and we'll see thousands and thousands and thousands of people in cities right across the country, as we have over the last 3 months, stepping up the campaign against this bill. But it's an absolute disaster for democracy in Britain.
The bill could also have a devastating impact on other marginalised communities in Britain.
This government is conducting a culture war. That's what it's doing. It's trying to undermine and eliminate aspects of black culture, Muslim culture, traveller culture. And when you think that people have had a way of life for thousands of years, and now you're going to introduce legislation, rather than facilitating their way of life as British people within a multicultural democracy, you're actually going to introduce a law that denies them their very way of life.
Okay. Criticism of government plans will continue amid fears that the potential damage might be irreversible.
The Police Crime Sentencing and Cause Bill continues to see mass opposition up and down the country, with experts deeply concerned about the potential long-term impact on civil liberties. Richard Sudam, London.
At a summit in Brussels, EU leaders have taken the highly controversial decision to advance plans on the vaccination of children against COVID-19. The European Commission says more than 300 million doses of COVID-19 vaccine will have been delivered to EU member states by the end of this week.
If we continue like this, we have confidence that we will be able to safely reopen our societies. So we must now focus on consolidating this progress. One important element that we've been discussing is the vaccination of minors.
EU leaders have chosen to completely ignore a plea from the World Health Organization. The WHO clearly states that vaccinating children and other low-risk groups in the EU happens at the expense of health workers and high-risk groups in poorer countries.
The People's Vaccine Alliance is a coalition of more than 50 organisations. In an extensive survey of epidemiologists commissioned by the Alliance, two-thirds warned mutations could render current COVID vaccines ineffective within a year. Hence the need, they stress, to vaccinate the world, not just rich countries.
EU leaders are under enormous pressure to somehow save the bloc's floundering economy, and they see the vaccination of their own people as the key. Millions have lost their jobs in the EU.